Lebanon has never been a strong nation state. There's something about the geography of the area, the peoples of the area, which have made it an unsettled bit of real estate on the face of our globe. Whenever those who draw lines have tried to create a country, whenever those who organize structures, political structures, have tried to create a coherent and stable community, Lebanon has fallen apart into internecine quarrels. And so it has been since the very dawn of history. Lebanon takes its name from the mountains, which rise precipitously off a very shallow coastal plain. In Hebrew, the word for white is lavan. The word Lebanon means simply the white mountains. And in most of the area, which runs from Tyre and Sidon up to Tripoli, the coastal plain may be only a mile or two wide. And then the mountains, 4,000 to 5,000 feet high, rise quickly and fall off into steep, narrow valleys, which rise again to the anti-Lebanons, until you drop off into the plain, which is a nation we call Syria. There's not a great deal of farmland, so the country has often been poor and has always needed to depend upon trade and commerce for its wealth. And because of the difficulty of transportation, of movement, there's been a degree of seclusion between the various communities in the Lebanon. Not only the cities which surround the various harbors in the eastern Mediterranean, but also the hilltop villages which have been established in the deep forests behind the narrow defiles of the mountains. The earliest people we know of in the Lebanon, Canaanites. Interestingly, the word Canaan, which appears in our Bible so frequently as describing the people who were indigenous to Palestine at the time of the conquest by the Israelites, our ancestors, appears very rarely in the first millennium documents. But they are the Phoenicians, as the settlers of the Lebanon were then called, are Canaanites, the direct descendants of those whom the Israelites fought with and ultimately took the land from, the land which we call Judea and Israel. The word Canaan, etymologists tell us, refers ultimately to a dark blue or dark purple dye, which was distilled from certain kinds of water creatures which could be found in that part of the world. And the word Phoenician is simply the Greek equivalent of this dark purple dye, of the word almost Canaan. And when the Israelites came in from the east, from across the Jordan, and began to move the Canaanites out of the city-states they had established in Israel, and at about the same time the Philistines, the sea peoples, came from Cyprus and Crete and moved the Canaanites off of the coastal plain of the south, the Canaanites migrated, such as survived, to the cities of Sidon, and Tyre, and Arvad, and Byblos, and established their strong city-states. They turned their backs to the land, and they turned their interests to the sea, and they became the great seafarers and merchants of the first millennium. They controlled Mediterranean traffic. Their ships took the tin and the copper and the beaten metalware and the textiles and the dyes of the Middle East across the Mediterranean to North Africa to Spain. Phoenician colonies were established all along the Mediterranean coast and even on the Atlantic coasts of Spain and of Morocco. Carthage was a Phoenician town. The Punic kingdoms of Carthage is simply the Latin form of the word Phoenician. The Phoenician country. And so they played a great role in the history of the world, these small city, harbor city-states during the first millennium. But even at the height of their material culture, they were not able to establish any kind of true political coherence. They shared a language, they shared a culture, they shared general religious points of view, but like Corinth and Athens and Sparta in Greece, and much later like Ferrara and Mantua and Florence and Venice and Renaissance Italy, these were city-states sharing a culture, sharing a language, but who fought constantly with each other for supremacy, for trade routes, for colonies, and for advantages. The word Lebanon means the White Mountains, but with a color red would be far more appropriate to this little bit of real estate, for it has been a killing ground since very early in its history. The Phoenician states of the West were destroyed by the Romans. Alexander the Great overwhelmed this part of the world at the end of the 4th century before the Common Era. But because of the deep forests and the high mountains and the narrow defiles of the land, imperial powers, whether they be Greek or Roman or Christian or Arab, were generally able to control only the very narrow coastal plain and the harbors, and the mountain fastness and the hilltop villages were places where robber bands, where people fleeing from whoever was the most recent invader, where people fleeing from persecution in another part of the Middle East would come and would settle and by their walls and their swords and their later their guns establish some kind of feisty independence. Now when we look at the present military groups which inhabit the Lebanon, most of these came within the last 13 or 1400 years, small groups who've established some kind of communal life by fighting with their neighbors, by maintaining their turf, by acting the way the Hatfields and the McCoys have acted in the hills of Kentucky ever since the establishment of settlement in that part of the world. They're hill peoples who carry their weapons with them and who know that they cannot trust the people in the next village because they would like to have whatever they can take from you. Now, the first of the modern actors who came into the Lebanon are the Maronite Christians. They come sometime after the year 670 of our era, about 1,200, 1,300 years ago. They came from Syria, from Antioch. They moved south a few hundred miles. And they became because of one of those bitter theological wars which marked Christianity during those centuries. Once Christianity became established in the Roman world, it was necessary, because Romans think this way, almost like modern Germans, that everything be standardized, that there be one way, one theology, one understanding of God. And the great argument which preoccupied the 5th century church was the question whether Jesus was man or God. What was the nature of their Lord? When did the man become God? Did man and God coexist in one nature? Were they consecutive? There was a man and then there was a God. Was there one nature or was there two? And thousands of people lost their lives in battles over this issue until at a conference at Chalcedon in 470, a vote was taken, and those who argued that Jesus had in fact two natures from the very beginning won the day. And everybody else, particularly the Monophysites, became heretics and subject to crusades, to attack by the Orthodox, particularly by the Byzantine emperors, who were the Orthodox emperors at the time. And then, because they loved to argue, another serious issue developed. And this issue was now that we have established that there were two natures in the Lord. Were there also two wills? Was there a human will and a divine will, or only one divine will, or only one human will to correspond to the two natures that were established as being part of Jesus' structure? And again, after much bloodshed, there was in Constantinople in 670 another great conference, council, At which time, those who argued that just as there were two natures, there were two separate wills won the day. And a group called the Monothelites, who had argued that there was only a single will and a double nature, became the heretics. And these are the ancestors of the Maronite Christians. And because they had centered around one of the great diocesan centers in Antioch, they were now pariahs. They were driven off, and they moved south into the mountains of the Lebanon. And about 500 years later, for reasons that we need not go into, they were reconciled with the Orthodox Church, the Church of Rome. And because they were the one group in the Lebanon which had ties to Europe, when Europe in the 17th and 18th century, particularly French Catholic Europe, began to be interested in developing the markets of the Lebanon, it was to these now Orthodox Catholics that the French turned, and the Maronites saw the advantage of sending their sons to the Sorbonne and of acting as factors for the great French merchant houses in the Middle East. And so they were the first group in the Lebanon to participate in the prosperity which the West began to bring to the Middle East. They tended to create a center in what had up to then been the very small town of Beirut, which becomes a great commercial center, which the Maronites in its early development largely dominate. So they become, by the 19th and 20th century, the most Western-oriented of the independent groups which had somehow survived history in that part of the world. The next of the groups to come in the Lebanon were the Orthodox Muslims, the Sunni. They come with the armies of the Arabs as they move up in the 7th century to conquer the world. And the Arabs manage to dominate the small coastal plain, but again they can't penetrate and dominate the hill country. And so the Sunni are by and large the bureaucrats sent down from first by the Umayyad emperors from Baghdad and later from the Abbasid emperors in Damascus. And they are the senior Arab elite who are the provincial governors and the minor bureaucrats who establish themselves by and large in the coastal cities where living is somewhat more comfortable. And for the most part, they make no attempt to go up into the mountains. That belongs to the lesser breeds without the law. And these elitists have no desire to mingle with the illiterate, with the peasant, with the feisty Hatfields McCoy types who are up there defending their turf. And then, of course, though we speak very easily in modern times of an Arab world or a Muslim world as if it is a coherent and unified entity, the Arab world, the Muslim world, is no more unified than Christendom, certainly not since the Protestant Reformation. And there developed very early, as you know, in the Arab world, a great schism between the Sunnis, who argue for the most part that authority, political authority, can legitimately be claimed by whoever can claim political authority. They are the pragmatists, if you will, of the Arab world. That is, if you are the general and your army is in control of the country, you are by divine right the caliph of the country, provided you are orthodox in your practice. And between the Shiites, the great dissident group, who argue that leadership, the caliphate, belongs properly only to the family of Muhammad, particularly to those who descend from Muhammad's son-in-law, Ali. And as you know, there was a great battle between these two groups in the late 7th and early 8th century. The Shiites lost. They become the underdogs. They become the advocates of the poor. They are those, for the most part, without power. In Persia, in Iran, they've become identified with an attempt of traditional Iranian Persian nationalism to rise again. And we've seen that that's been a persistent movement, as we see with Khomeini in our own day. They appealed particularly in their theology to the outside groups. And occasionally when these groups, as some of the Berber kingdoms in North Africa, were able to establish authority, Shia, for a period of time, would become the dominant religious group in one or another part of the Arab world. But by and large, they are the poor and the persecuted, and a number of these groups migrated over time into the mountains of the Lebanon for defense, for security. They are the semi-literate, they are the poor, they are the peasantry, and they remain such in their mountainous areas down to our own day. And finally, the last of the major groups that move into the Lebanon are an offshoot of the Shia, we know as the Druze. They are people who begin in Egypt during one of those brief periods of time when under a dynasty known as the Fatimids in the 11th century, Egypt is ruled by a Shiite group. These are a group of people who, for one reason or another, become convinced that one of the Shiite caliphs, actually a madman by the name of Hakim II, that Hakim, when he died, did not in fact die, but was hidden away by Allah, by God, and that he will return at the end of days as the Messiah. And when he returns, the golden age for which all medieval traditions longed will occur. And they developed around this mystery of the hidden Iman a set of ideas about a secret cult, an esoteric cult, which is not to be revealed to anyone in its basic essence. And they left Egypt. They were persecuted in Egypt when the Fatimids fell from power, and they migrated north, and they too settled as mountain people in the Lebanon and have remained there in Syria and in parts of Israel to this day. Now, whenever any major change occurred in that part of the world, there was a reshuffling of the territory and of the relative balance of power between these major groups and some minor groups in that part of the area. When the Crusaders came through, then the Christians had a moment where they were able to expand their territorial base. When Saladin and the Arabs pushed the Crusaders out, then the Muslim groups were able to push back the Christians into their mountain fastness. Now, during the Middle Ages, particularly in the 17th and 18th century, there were various attempts by the feudal nobles who represented these various groups to create some kind of conciliar movement which would minimize the bloodshed, the revenge-taking, the inevitable fighting that was going on, where they could meet, albeit always accompanied by armed bodyguards, and adjust issues over land, over water, over territory, whatever it be, between them. And sometimes they were successful. More often than not, they were not. Usually there was one among them who tried to establish his authority as supreme. In the early part of the 19th century, because of the new influence of Western monies and French influence, a Maronite chieftain, a feudal leader, one of the ancestors of Pierre Gamaliel, who is now the president of the Lebanon, tried to establish this kind of authority, but he went obviously too far. And in 1860, the Druze, feeling threatened, rose up, and there was a terrible massacre of Maronite Christians and several years of war, until the French, using the authority, which was really that of the Ottoman Turks, who were the political power which supposedly controlled the area, were able to reestablish some kind of peace. And the French, because of their particular interest in this part of the world, began to do what you see the West trying to do with all the complex problems in the Middle East, to devise some kind of elegant diplomatic solution which would adjust all of the problems of the particular area so that France could continue to benefit economically from its interest and stake there. And so the French did, in fact, devise an elegant solution, the very kind of solution that I'm sure Western statesmen think they can devise for the West Bank and for Gaza. And what was the solution? The solution was to create a political entity called Lebanon, which would be governed by a democratically elected leader and Congress. But the voting would not be done as we do in the United States, one man, one vote. It would be done on an arbitrary division of authority. The Maronites, as the largest population group at the time, would be guaranteed the presidency, which was the most powerful administrative office. The Sunni Muslims, because they represented a dominant Muslim group, would be guaranteed the prime ministership. The Shiite Muslims, as the most populous but poorest part of the population, would be guaranteed the speaker of the legislature. And there would be assigned seats in the legislature given on a basis of proportional representation determined at Quai d'Orsay rather than determined by votes in the Lebanon. And so in 1923, when the League of Nations gave to the French government a mandate over the Lebanon, much like the British were given the mandate over Palestine. The French imposed this very delicate and elegant diplomatic solution. And as it is always the case with diplomatic solutions of this kind, it didn't last very, very long, because there is always a political reality, a power reality, which undermines what diplomats think to be their brilliance. In this case, what undermined the French solution was the growing prosperity of the Maronite and Sunni middle class. It's one of the great truths of the 20th century that the more you have, the less children you have. And so the poorest elements in the population, the Shiites, multiplied. And Western medical missionaries were particularly helpful in seeing that more Shiite children survived. And so the proportions of the population changed radically in the 20th century. The Maronites, who had been the dominant political power in terms of both economic prosperity and numbers, retained their economic prosperity, but in terms of the population, they became second and then third to the Sunni and to the Shia. And the Shia, being the group which is multiplying very quickly, which is the poorest part of the population, becomes the most populous numerically in the Lebanon. The French are able to maintain some kind of modus vivendi simply by their authority until the end of the Second World War. And then, following a long diplomatic history, they grant independence to a country whose borders have been determined by people who live in Europe. And it is assumed that one can have a central authority in a country which, in fact, has never had a central authority. And in 1947, just a year before Israel becomes an independent country, the Lebanon becomes an independent nation. Now, what happens? There's an attempt to maintain the modus vivendi, the diplomatic solution, which had been shaped by the French. Obviously, those who are better educated and more prosperous are given the advantages in this system, which was shaped in 1921, but must now conform to a new reality in the late 1940s. And there are many elements now which are new. In the first instance, there is a renaissance of Arab nationalism. This is the era where Israel is being established, where there's a great protest in the Arab world against the intrusion of Europe into the Arab world. This is the era which gives rise to Nasserism, with its overtones both of Arab nationalism and of a kind of populistic socialism, which will throw out the notables, the feudal structures of the of countries like the Lebanon. And so you have in the 1950s, as you remember, an appeal at one point from the Prime Minister, the Maronite Prime Minister Shamoun, to General President Eisenhower, that we send in our Marines. Why? It has nothing to do with Israel, but because Syria is now sponsoring a Nasserite attack on the Maronite Christians, and we in fact send in 10,000 Marines, and we stabilize for a year or two the situation. Persistently during the late 50s and early 60s and middle 60s, there were underground revolutionary groups, largely militant Muslim groups, seeking to undermine and overthrow this government, which to a very large degree serves the interests of the West and serves the privileges of the Christian groups. And of course, with the 1947-48 attack by the Arab states against Israel, there is the movement into the Lebanon of about 200,000 Arab refugees. The Lebanon did not fight against Israel in any significant way during that war. But at the end of the war, she's burdened with the largest number of Arab refugees, and the Arabs will not allow the Lebanese government to disperse these people. Though there are jobs for them, there's no empty space. They are kept in the camps and become a festering cancer, another minority to deal with in this part of the world, which is already one which is riven by such groups. So there is now a new minority in the Lebanon. There is a new Arab anti-Western nationalism at work. There is the inevitable revolution of those who have the least against those who have the most. which is taking place throughout the Arab world, and the Lebanon stumbles on as best it can. Group begins to fight against group. The various groups in the Arab world are willing to provide arms to their surrogates in the Lebanon. The Libyans provide arms to the Sunnis. The Israelis provide arms to the Southern Lebanese Army, which protects its border. The Syrians provide arms to the Shiites. And also from various parts of the Arab world and from Europe, the Maronites are able to purchase arms of one kind or another. And quickly, these militias are not only the militias that you see patrolling the streets, but they have their underground killing squads. And bloodshed leads to bloodshed until the city of Beirut is divided in two between Christian and Muslim sectors. And within the Muslim sector itself, there are turfs which belong to the Shiites and those which belong to the Sunni and those which belong to Hezbollah. You have a medieval city, as you had in medieval Italy, where everybody must carry his gun, not his sword, but his gun with him, or he will not survive. Then, in 1970, tragedy again comes to the Lebanon. In this case, the tragedy begins not in the Lebanon, but in Jordan. One of the truths about the PLO is that everybody in the Arab world loves the PLO as long as it's someplace else. The Egyptians, who spawned the PLO, quickly drove the PLO. The Syrians, who make the most of the activities of the PLO, were quick to incorporate the PLO divisions into their army. The Jordanians were somewhat more tolerant. Hussein is very, very patient, very crafty man. But finally, the danger to his own state by the existence of the PLO armed brigades in the north of the Jordan became so great, and the fear of Israeli retaliation so real, that you'll recall that he attacked on what they call Black Sunday, a Sunday in August. He attacked the army of the PLO and seriously defeated it. And it was routed, and the soldiers fled. They fled to Syria, and Syria said, keep going. And they went, and they went, and they landed in the Lebanon. And in the Lebanon, they drifted to these refugee camps, and they became the militia of the refugee camps, and then they became almost an army in exile, and then they became a state coming into being. And the world has tended to forget that when the Israelis plunged into the Lebanon in the summer of 1982, you recall that they found an independent state existing in the southern Lebanon, run by the PLO, with arms manufacturing and business of various kinds, with schools and with its own economic infrastructure, and with weapons enough to equip several modern divisions. So now the Lebanon has not only its traditional minorities who are always warring with one another, but they have an armed state within a state, that of the Palestinians. And there's constant bloodshed and constant fighting. One group will wipe out a village, and the other group will wait for a moment, a propitious moment, and then they will, in fact, retaliate. Now, as the PLO moved into the Lebanon, the attacks on Israel, both from the sea, which had begun in the Lebanon, and from land, infiltrating across the border, and also the rocketing of the cities in the Galilee by the Katyusha, finally led the Israelis to decide that they had better take an action in order to clear out the southern Lebanon further from their border. There was already a buffer zone which Major Haddad and the southern Lebanese army was in fact protecting for the Israelis. And there were some UN forces there, but they were relatively ineffective. And there began in the summer of 1982 that attack which they called Peace in the Galilee. The original announced purpose of the attack was to move 40 kilometers into the Lebanon, which would give the Israeli border some breathing space, which would remove the Lebanese border at least 40 kilometers and 24 miles from most of the Israeli settlements and give them some kind of protection. The first day or two of this attack was monumentally successful. The feared SAM surfaced air missiles of the Syrians were knocked out. The Syrian Air Force was cleared from the skies. The Israelis broke through the Palestinian strong points in the mountains and they quickly began to move up towards the highway which links Beirut to the east. And then a fateful decision was made, or rather two fateful decisions. The first was not to attack the Syrian army, which allowed the Syrian army to remain in place. It was quickly refurbished, re-equipped by the Russians, and was able, because it sits on about two-thirds of the territory of the Lebanon, it was able to exert throughout the last 3 years a very strong, suasive presence to be the conduit by which arms and interests and mercenaries and whatnot were fed to the various groups the Syrians wanted to sponsor. The second was Mr. Sharon's decision to plunge on towards Beirut. What was in his mind is not completely clear. Mr. Begin seems to have been almost mystical in his belief that if the Israelis could strengthen the Christian Maronites in the control of the Lebanon, they would be doing for the world what the Christian West was unwilling to do, that is, protect the Western influence, the Christians in the Lebanon, and that the Christians in return would be able to establish a relatively stable government in the Lebanon, which would not be a danger to Israel, and the Lebanon would join Egypt as countries which Israel would not have to fear in terms of any immediate attack. But his basic interest seems to have been in the public relations which would accrue to Israel for doing the West's, for supporting the West's interest in the Lebanon. Because the truth of the Lebanon as seen from the Middle East is that it is a continuation and a completion of the work of the Crusades. That is, the Westerners came, and the Arabs are patient, and ultimately the Westerners will be driven out. And the Maronites and the Melchites and the other Christians in Lebanon represent the West, though they've lived there for probably for longer than any of the Arab groups. And so this kind of mystique is at work, and Begin recognized it. And Begin thought he would be successful in accomplishing the undoing of the mystique and in showing the West that Israel was in fact doing its work, the work that the West was too timid really to complete in the Middle East. Sharon is another case. Sharon is Israel's General Patton, a tough-minded, charismatic human being who seems to believe that you can settle everything the way you settle a prize fight, by war. That everything has a neat solution. Someone wins and someone loses, and it's better for Israel to win on the battlefield. And though it was never clear to many in Israel how Israel could win in the Lebanon, if you define winning as taking over a territory, how in fact it could capture a town the size of Beirut without tremendous loss, and if it captured the town, how it could police the town, he plunged on far beyond the 40-kilometer line, and Israel suddenly found itself at the doors of Beirut, confronting first a world press which saw the bombing of Beirut not as pinpoint bombing of targets, but as the indiscriminate bombing of Coventry or of Dresden, and sent back, as you recall, these frantic reports of the destruction of the city, of Israel's violence in war. And Israel was forced to pull up shy of Beirut, and suddenly there was a Western force interposing itself between the PLO and the Israelis. And you'll remember that famous scene where an American lieutenant walks out directly to confront an Israeli tank as it goes on patrol. Suddenly, instead of doing the bidding of the West, as the Israelis saw it, the Israelis were seen as people who were undoing the interests of the West in the Lebanon. And that was the beginning of the turning of the tide for the Israelis. And since that day, it has been a sad history. 640 young Israelis have now lost their life in the Lebanon. Several hundred of these just during the period when Israel has already announced that she's going to retreat steadily back to her own borders. The high hopes of 1982 have disappeared, been shattered. The West has no presence in the Lebanon any longer. The feeble attempts of the West to interpose a multinational force failed completely. And we cannot even protect Western people of goodwill, teachers and refugee workers as they walk about the streets of Beirut. So the West has lost face in the Lebanon. The Israelis are about to retire. The various factions are doing what they have done from since time immemorial, fighting with each other for control, for turf. A new situation has come into being, and they want to be sure that they control as much of the land contiguous to their areas as they possibly can. And the dominant force in the Lebanon remains Syria, whose army sits there in the Bekaa Valley, which lies between the anti-Lebanon and the Lebanese mountains, and they control what is happening in that part of the world. When the PLO and the Tripoli, those who were still loyal to Arafat, began to become independent, they simply set in brigades of the PLO that they controlled, and they whipped them in battle. They have been obviously providing the explosives for the car bombs. They have been providing passage for the Iranian-trained Hezbollah, the martyr fanatics of the Shia, who have been so violent in their terrorism, both to Israel and to other elements in the Lebanon. And it's been a sad, sad history, which we've been reading day after day in our newspapers. Israel has had to resort to what it calls an iron hand operation in order to secure its own lines of retreat as it begins to return to Israel itself. The Israelis are tired of the war. They're tired of they think of Lebanon as a swamp which will destroy and suck up into its quicksand any group which attempts to impose its will on that part of the world. And I guess if there is any hope for that the Israelis cherish is that the Syrians, as the last remaining imperial power, will themselves be drawn into that swamp and will suffer in their turn. Now, when one looks at the Lebanon, there's a question. And the question is this. When the Israelis attacked, the people in the southern Lebanon, particularly the Shiites, welcomed the Israelis enthusiastically. Why, 3 years later, the sudden reversal of concern? Well, the Arabs have a proverb which says, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And one of the truths about Lebanon is that each one of these groups which fight for turf and for power hates the other. And the great enemy of the Shia in the south is the PLO. The PLO took over their turf. The PLO imposed its taxes on their people. The PLO are Shia, are Sunni, and they are Christian. The Shiites are not. The PLO was to a very large degree supported and financed by the Gaddafi and the Lebanon. And this was a particular cause of anger to the Shiites. Being the poorest and the least organized of all the peoples in the Lebanon, the Shiites responded in the 1950s and early 1960s to the charismatic presence of a religious teacher by the name of Musa ibn Sadr. Musa ibn Sadr was a Shiite priest who was trained in Iran, in Persia, in one of the great academies there, who returned to the Shiite communities of Lebanon and organized religious self-help communes called the Amal in each of the mountaintop villages of the south, which were dominated by his Shiite confreres. And he gave to the Shiites for the first time a sense of some power, and he gave them the sense that they could demand and gain some presence that had significance in the new emerging federal government. They could claim a certain amount of the tax monies be returned to their communities for various projects of one type or another. He was a great figure, their beloved leader. And then in 1979, the Libyan government kidnapped al-Sadr, and he's disappeared. Obviously, they killed him. And the Amal, the Shiite, know this full well, and they have no greater enemy than Gaddafi. And if Gaddafi is supporting the PLO, and the PLO presence there is very visible in terms of its extortion, its taxes, its willingness to kick in your door and take whatever you have, then anyone who liberates you from this force is your friend. But at the same time, Shia, we must remember, are people who have a martyr complex, that the way to get to heaven is to be martyred in your cause. And the Israelis, not quite conscious of all of their hopes of what might or might not be accomplished with the Amal, with the Shia, continued Begin's vision that Israel would somehow strengthen a strong central Christian Maronite pro-Western government in Beirut, and that Israel would continue to be supported by the army of Major Haddad, which is Sunni and Christian, along its border in southern Lebanon. And even when Haddad died, they continued to give support to this group. Now, all these groups are the enemy of the Amal, or the enemy of the Shia. And against the recommendation of one or two of their military advisors, the Israelis, instead of saying to the Shia, this is your turf, police it. All that we demand is peace. What they did was essentially to be concerned primarily with how the Falange, the Christian groups, would be able to move their army back and forth in order to protect them from various forces in the south. And they suddenly became identified in the minds of the Shia. Now they were no longer the enemy of my enemy. They were now the friend of my enemy. And they become my enemy because of that. And so there was a swift reversal of interests, of concerns. Whether or not this might have worked out differently, one can't know in the complex of Levantine diplomacy. But this much just remains clear, that the leading figure, the sort of feudal leader of the Shiites, a man named Barry, was limited in his ability to deal with the Israelis because the Syrians said to him, essentially, if you want to be part of the governing council, you can't have anything to do with the Israelis. Syria is still the rejectionist state of all the states that border Israel. But at the same time, he continues, as do the Shiites generally, to look upon the PLO as their greatest enemy. And so, though it's interesting, Barry has been given the political control of West Beirut, of Muslim Beirut. And in West Beirut, he has prohibited any Palestinian from bearing an arm. They still look on the Palestinians as their enemy, their number one enemy. And the Shia, one way or another, will see to it that the PLO and their forces in the Lebanon are never significantly armed again. That is, provided that the Shia really gain some power in the Lebanon. So the Israelis have been trying to discover a way to tap this anti-PLO interest of the Shia, and at the same time to protect themselves from the violence which has been sown among the Shia, not only by this change of what seeming change of Israel's loyalties, but by the fact that they have now been interpenetrated by young, militant, mystic, martyr-seeking people who have been sent by Iran, people who are caught up in the mystique that the Shia will again dominate the world, and who are the people who are organizing these raids which are costing so much blood and anguish and making so many sad headlines in the press. When one looks at the Lebanon today, one clearly looks at a country that is no country. There is no central government except on paper. There is an army. The army can move only when the militias of the various feudal groups allow it passage. And most recently, when the prime minister of the Lebanon, Pierre Gamayel, found himself under attack from his own Falange, from his own Christian group, where there was a very successful officers' revolt a week and a half ago against his authority, it diminished even that support which the present government has. And so what we have essentially is what we've had for the last 2,000, 3,000 years. A group of well-armed, supported largely from the outside groups, at war with one another, angry, bitter, fearful, very little chance that they will in fact come together to create a central government. There's no reason to believe that. And as Israel leaves, the influence obviously of the Syrians grows apace. Israel came into the Lebanon in order to secure the government of the Maronite Christians. 3 weeks ago, Pierre Gamayel, the Maronite Christian prime minister, president of the Lebanon, announced that he was fully supportive of all the terrorist attacks against the Israeli troops, even as they had announced they would fully withdraw from the Lebanon. So what we have for the time being is a chastened Israel, which will retreat to its borders without having gained really any of the goals that it sought for in the Lebanon, except the elimination of the quasi-existing Palestinian state. And Israel, which has been shocked by the fact that this was this first voluntary war, it decided the time and the place, and it has been its first unsuccessful war. In Israel, where a number of young people for the first time and older men refused to serve in the Israeli army when the army crossed the border into the Lebanon or crossed the 40-kilometer line in the Lebanon. In Israel burdened by, as we are burdened by Vietnam, by the failure of a policy and the consequent lack of faith in those who organize policy. A West which is totally impotent in that part of the world, and the consequence of that is the encouragement of all those in that part of the world who believe that all the influence of the West can be eradicated, the Crusades can be undone. Stronger is Syria, which temporarily will call the shots in the Lebanon. All the groups will, one way or another, make some kind of peace with Syria. She is there. She's only a mile or two away. Nothing can happen which goes beyond what she will tolerate. Whether Syria will ultimately be drawn down as Israel and as France and as the West were drawn down to the swamp of the Lebanon remains to be seen. Nothing will happen, I'm convinced, until the Iraq-Iranian war is over. Syria has sided with Iran. Iraq has good reason to be bitterly angry with Syria, which cut off her pipeline to the West and therefore her reserves, her ability to buy arms. There will come a day of reckoning between Iraq and Iran, the two radical Arab states, inevitably. But whether it will be sooner or later, no one knows. And when it does, her ability to involve her troops, her wealth in the Lebanon, will be diminished. But one of the great truths of the Arab world is this: what exists today will change tomorrow. You can't count on continuity, which is why all of these wonderfully sophisticated diplomatic attempts to create some kind of structure which will allow for a resolution of problems ultimately fail. The Arab world is going through a number of concurrent revolutions. Culturally and intellectually, it must move from the Middle Ages to the 21st century. And has begun that move is now only in its second or third decade.